This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Call Me Ishmael. Thus begins Herman Melville's great novel, Moby Dick, the story of Captain Ahab and his obsession to destroy the whale that has taken his leg. Now another story unfolds, that of Ahab's wife, Una Spencer. Here is how she begins her story. Captain Ahab was neither my first husband nor my last. Una Spencer's story is the story of the new novel from Sina Jeter Naslund. It's titled Ahab's Wife, or The Stargazer. Sina Jeter Naslund is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your questions and comments for our guest are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Sina Jeter Naslund earned her MA and PhD degrees at the University of Iowa, where she was a member of the Iowa Writers Workshop. She is the founder of the Louisville Review. She directs the creative writing program at the University of Louisville, and she's also on the MFA faculty at Vermont College. Her previous books include The Disobedience of Water and Sherlock in Love. Ahab's Wife, or The Stargazer, is published by William Morrow. Sina Jeter Naslund, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's nice to be with you.
What got you thinking about Ahab's wife?
Oh, many things led to Ahab's wife, but I'll tell you, the moment I conceived the novel, I remember it very vividly. I was driving a rented car around in Boston. My novel, Sherlock in Love, had just come out, and I was feeling on top of the world. I wasn't lost. I felt wonderful. And then I had a vision and heard a voice. And the vision was of a woman on a roof walk or widow's walk close to the sea at night. She was looking out, hoping to see her husband coming home in his whaling ship. At a certain moment, she realized he was not coming home, not then, not ever, and her gaze shifted from out to up into the starry sky. She began to ask her own philosophical questions with that. Who am I in the face of all this vast glory? What's my place in the cosmos? And as she asked those questions and began her own spiritual searching, I heard the voice say the first sentence of the novel, Captain Ahab was neither my first husband nor my last. And mm-hmm. with that, I knew I had a novel if I wanted to put my fanny on the seat long enough to write it.
Well, we're happy you did.
Thank you.
That is such a wonderful beginning. Did you know when you came up with that line that that would be the first line?
I thought it would. You know, all of this happened in a moment. As I say, I was driving a car. It happened faster than I can tell about it. And it did seem labeled the first sentence of the novel, not just a sentence, but the first sentence. And I knew the vision of the woman on the roof walk would come very late in the novel. So, in a sense, I had the structure of the novel and some of its main ideas in just those two moments. For myself.
Yeah. And when did that woman on the widow's walk become Ahab's wife?
Well, you know, the sentence refers to Ahab, so I really didn't have any choice about that. People have sometimes asked me, you know, why not Captain Brown instead of Captain uh-huh. Ahab was neither my first husband nor my last. But that's the way it was given to me. It was always linked to Melville's great novel, Moby Dick. And while I had that first sentence, which implies three husbands, I did not know who the first husband would be, nor the third husband. So I went on a voyage of discovery with my character. While my novel does have its roots deep in Moby Dick, I do want to say, Celeste, that readers have and can enjoy Ahab's Wife without ever having read Moby Dick. My book is an independent, standalone novel.
Right. When did you first read Moby Dick, and what did you think?
I first read Moby Dick when I was 12 or 13 years old. I was about to go to high school. I remember, in fact, taking it off the shelf of the Birmingham Public Library in Alabama, where I grew up, and feeling it was something of a moment. I wrote my first book report on Moby Dick, I remember that also because the teacher asked me in front of the class, lounging back on her desk, she said, "Now, Sina, are these your ideas or the ideas of some art critic?" So I quickly said, "Oh, well, I thought it myself," and she believed me. But it was a wonderful question because I didn't know there were art critics, and I didn't know the novel was considered art. I thought art was paintings and sculpture. So it was a sentence that really opened my mind, her question did. The part of the book report that she questioned was a statement to the effect that the sea was such an important presence in Moby Dick that it should be considered as a character. And I think it was the sea and the depictions of its various moods and mysteries that really fascinated me on that early first reading of Moby Dick.
Yeah. You know, the mention of women is just that in Melville's book.
Yes, it is. It's mentioned, Melville mentions in passing, that Captain Ahab did have a wife. She's not given any name. She's not given any life. And I think I've done those things for her. I did pay very careful attention to those few mentions in Moby Dick. And maybe I could talk about those a little bit.
Sure.
One of them is by the man who is a co-owner of the ship, the Pequod. His name is Captain Peleg. And Captain Peleg says of Ahab's wife that she's a sweet, resigned girl. Now, my novel doesn't depict her that way, and there's a reason why it doesn't. Captain Peleg is something of a fool. He's like Polonius in Hamlet. He's a windbag full of advice. And he also says that he himself is a great deal like Captain Ahab because they swear a lot. But that's the most superficial of resemblances. So when I read Captain Peleg saying Una is a sweet, resigned girl, and he's been established as a windbag who's wrong about everything, then the door opens in the other direction for me. I do know from reading Moby Dick that Ahab has not been married very long, and it was on the second voyage after his marriage that he lost his leg to Moby Dick. We're inclined to think Ahab has always lost his leg, and he's been hunting for Moby Dick and his desire to have revenge all his life. That's not true, according to Melville. He lost his leg on the second voyage after the marriage. On the third voyage after the marriage, he simply didn't come back. On that third voyage, just before the big chase scene at the end of Moby Dick, Ahab is speaking to Starbuck, his first mate, and they're speaking of home and how they would like to go home. And it's clear from those passages that Ahab really loved his wife and his child very much. He says to Starbuck, they're talking about the weather, that if he were home, it would be time now for the boy to wake up from his nap. And then Ahab says, his mother tells him of me, of cannibal old me, how I am abroad upon the deep, but will yet come back to dance him again. And then a little bit later he says to Starbuck, stand close to me, Starbuck. Let me look into a human eye. It's better than to gaze into sea or sky, better than to gaze upon God. This is the magic glass, man. I see my wife and my child in thine eye. So that's a lot of intensity from Ahab about his wife and child and real longing for them. And I wanted to create a character in my Una Spencer who was worthy of that kind of intensity. So I had an important clue, I felt, from Moby Dick as to what kind of person Una was.
They share a passion for
yes,
one another and for living.
Yes, they do. And they also are people who are unconventional and skeptical by nature. They question things that other people might not question. And they want to know, really, the philosophical nature of the world that we live in. Is this a world governed by a benign God? Is it a world where good and evil war with each other? Or do we live in an indifferent universe? And certainly Ahab considers that. He wonders if there's a reality behind the appearance of the world in Moby Dick. And Una has some of these same questions. They're also people who have suffered a good bit in their lives. They've had a lot of hardship. I give Una an ordeal at sea, in a sense, to temper her and make her a worthy companion for a man who's much older and much more experienced than she is.
Yeah. Early in the book, you give us a good look at their relationship, and I was wondering if you would read a passage from that point in the book. It's the beginning of a chapter titled Reverie.
Yes, indeed. This is chapter 4 in the novel, and in a sense, Una is thinking about her past in this chapter, and particularly her past with Captain Ahab. She's on Nantucket, a particular part of Nantucket at Sconset Beach, which is the eastmost edge of Nantucket, and she's lounging around, daydreaming. I'll read now. This time of reverie I have spent lounging on a golden sand dune. Such a mild blue day it is here in Nantucket, where the breeze sometimes whips me, sometimes caresses me. Yet, intact Ahab, back from his first voyage, once said of just such a changeable breeze, this contrast is the way of life itself. All playfully, he added, but were I God, then would every day be invariantly good. Then he asked me if he might be the God of my world. I teased back and denied him that. Never, I said, as long as sky arches over or earth lies under. Once, out of guilt and grief, I had given my will away, but ever after I kept my soul for myself. And Ahab asked, thou wouldst have me unvault the firmament to prove my godhood, exalt the valleys, and what dost thou require that I demand of the sea? Then I spoke with more conviction and said, certainly you are not lord of that, for the sea takes you from me, and am I not your heaven? Here I trace the zaggy mark that began at his temple. How can you be lord of an element having the power to take you from your heaven? Ahab scooped up sand, and in a warm trickle he poured it on the back of my other hand. The sea has brought me back once to thee. Oh, Ahab's smile, rare and shy, precious then and now to my constricting heart. For even on that balmy day, I would have thought, what if those lapping waters should not bring him back the second time or the third time? Perhaps I swallowed and said to Ahab, if the sea bring you back a second time and a third time, then truly will I make you lord of me and of our bed. But he was already that. In our happy leisure, I might have thought indolently of the brown people so far away on the Pacific Islands, perhaps lounging on their own sand, which Ahab said was white as sugar, not golden like these grains. I saw Ahab as a young man going to them. I did not begrudge him his happiness there. In imagination, I became one of them. From the women on the islands, he had learned how to touch the magic places on my body. If there were children left behind in the South Seas, well, I would people the world with Ahab's. Once I asked him, what would a girl child be with his spirit? And he answered, Una, thou art she. If there were children begotten in the South Seas, they would be my older brothers and sisters in age, for in his middle years, Ahab went to the island women no longer, saying it was not right for a captain. He had no prejudice against the mingling of brown and white. I teased him home from that short first voyage as we picnicked on the Nantucket Moor, said that certainly Captain Peleg and probably Captain Bildad used to sport in the grass hunts, but even during that first idyllic homecoming, if I saw the moral fervor was on his brow, I desisted. It would not be kindness to tease Ahab on the subject of good or evil, and whether simply custom makes it so. He believed the moral powers, demonic and heaven-generated, are separate things, must be separate to be themselves eternal. But I see them all nested and layered together, sometimes with no clear seam between, but a gradation, transient. He wanted something ultimate and absolute. If there be reality beyond the appearance, be that reality ultimately good or evil or indifferent, then it must be so, always. That second homecoming brought him home dismasted, one-legged, raging. Yet he would go forth again to war upon the deep. Before he left, he, seated, called me to stand between his knees, one leg bent naturally, the other out-thrust in tapering ivory. He twisted the sculpted nuptial bracelet on my wrist and made the whales depicted there swim round. Wouldst thou have an ornate ivory cross? He asked me, and the flicker of rebellion and wildness galloped across his face. I do not hold well with such symbols, and he knew it. Nay, my wife, he said, for he could ever read my thoughts. The storm gathered in his mien. My girl wife shall have a crown, and I will carve it myself from the jawbone of Moby Dick. He reached up, placed his hands on my hair, surrounded my skull, and squeezed till he trembled, his force caught statically between his knowledge of my human frailty and his power. Yet I thought how I might yield unharmed, and I knelt till my knees were on the carpet and I looked up at him. Then he left off squeezing my head, but those strong hands had bequeathed the pressure of a crown that never was to be, except as memory and imagination conjoined to circumscribe my scalp. Art thou afraid? He asked. When I shook my head, no, he kissed me upon the lips passionately and then upon the brow in tender blessing. Shall I stop there?
Yes, I think that's a good place to stop. Sina Jeter Naslund reading from Ahab's Wife, her book Ahab's Wife or The Stargazer. Una seems to be a woman who would be at home in our world, in the contemporary world.
Yes, you know, in Ahab's Wife, I'm writing in the 19th century period, but of course I'm writing for 20th century readers. And I did want her to have some concerns that were not only consistent with those in Moby Dick, but also concerns consistent with our own time. And I'm happy to say that a number of the critics have said that I am able to do both those things at once, to give her a spirit compatible to a modern woman's, and still she doesn't seem out of place in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, where the book is set.
Yeah. It is a time, I think, when historically there is a departure from religious dogma toward exploration.
Very much so. This is the time of the rise of the Transcendentalists, for just one example. And I do have historical characters in my book. I have some people who are well-known, such as Emerson and Hawthorne, and also some women who are perhaps a little less well-known. One of them is Margaret Fuller, who was a friend of Emerson's. She was an editor of the Dial magazine. She traveled to Europe as the first foreign correspondent of either sex for Horace Greeley's Tribune. And I also have a woman named Moriah Mitchell, who historically did live on Nantucket, was an astronomer, in fact, the first person in the world to ever discover a comet using a telescope. I've put these historical women beside Una for a reason. I didn't want someone of our time to look back and say, oh, but women were not like Una back in the 1840s. They were quiet and stayed at home. Here are two historical figures who did not stay quietly at home. They had their own work, one a great woman of literature and the other a great woman of science. So, you know, I wanted to suggest that in that time, and really I think throughout history, there have always been women who have wanted their own place in the universe, who have not wanted to simply be in the shadow of men.
Suffragists, abolitionists,
yes,
scientists,
temperance workers.
Mm-hmm.
Every stripe of activity really has its woman activists, I think, to be considered. You know, we look back at history now sometimes and say it's not just the story of the generals and the politicians who were men, but women played a role too, and there's been a real movement to bring the women's story into history. When I look back at the landscape of literature, I sometimes see the potential for developing women characters, and that was part of the impulse behind my working with Ahab's Wife. I had the experience of traveling with my daughter when she was 10 or 11 years old, and we listened to a lot of books on tape. We also ate all the candy we wanted to. That was one of the rules. And another rule was we stopped for any reason whatsoever, from bathroom to interesting trees. But we listened to books on tape, and she loved these abridged books of David Copperfield, Little Women, Huckleberry Finn, Moby Dick, among others. The book she loved most was Moby Dick because she started reciting whole passages. And, of course, I was pleased as a parent that my child was responding to the grandeur of Melville's language. On the other hand, I thought, too bad there's no great woman in there for her to quote or identify with. And how is it that Huckleberry Finn and Moby Dick have been the candidates for the great American novel title, an informal title, and neither of those books have any important women in them? So it seemed to me this was too bad that 50% of the population was left out of Melville's novel. And he has men there from all different parts of the globe, all different colors, all different religions, speaking many languages, but he's still short 51% in having a microcosm of the world. So that thought had lodged in the back of my mind, and I forgot it until that moment when I was in Boston and saw the vision and heard the voice. But I'm sure that, that moment of envisioning Ahab's wife was partly left over from that earlier car trip. It had been 3 or 4 months earlier.
Yeah. When you were a girl, it's obvious from the anecdote you told earlier in the interview about being asked by your teacher, are these your words? Are these your thoughts or those of an art critic when you suggested that in Moby Dick the sea should be thought of as character? So you've been a good and careful reader, it seems to me, all your life. When you were a girl reading, would Una Spencer and Susan, another character in Ahab's Wife, and other women in Ahab's Wife, would these have been characters you had craved to read about since you began reading?
Well, I would certainly have been happy to have read about Una or Susan, who is a slave who's escaped from the South. I loved the stories of adventuresome girls. I loved Little Women and Jane Eyre. I first thought about becoming a writer when I was about 10 years old and I was reading the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. These had been read to me when I was younger, and I read them many times. I think she's a marvelous, real literary treasure on the American scene. But I was in Birmingham. It was 100 degrees. It was very hot. No air conditioning for us at that time. And I was reading a description of a snowstorm, a blizzard, freezing, horrible winds, voices in the wind, and I suddenly realized that I was trembling with cold. And then I pulled out of the dream of reading and thought, but it's hot here. These words, this language, made me feel something different. And then I thought, I would like to be able to do that with language. And so, I've always remembered that as a moment where the world of writing fiction really called to me because of its ability to transport people almost physically in that instance.
Yeah, very powerful.
So I do think that many people besides myself, of course, are interested in young women and girls reading about characters with whom they can identify. I don't mean to imply they're the only audience for this book. I've been very happy that the book has spoken to many male readers, and many people who have loved Moby Dick have been open to this book as well. My editor, Paul Bresnik at William Morrow, wrote a dissertation called In the Wake of the Pequod, and he loves Moby Dick so much that he and his friends read it out loud once a year, the whole thing. It's about 24 hours to do that. So I'm very happy to have appeal to that audience as well. My book was chosen as a main selection for the Book of the Month Club, and also there the editor was a real lover of Melville and was male. So I do think it's possible to do many things at once in writing a novel. And while I wanted to create a character that my daughter or her friends might identify with, I also wanted to create one that would appeal to people who had loved Moby Dick all their lives.
Yeah. Now, when this book began to stir, your daughter was 10.
Yes.
She's almost out of her teens today.
Yes, she is. She's 18 now.
Yeah. So once you begin sitting down and writing Ahab's Wife, did the two of you talk about the book and the character that you created, Una Spencer?
Sometimes we did. I remember talking to her at one point saying, I was struggling with something in the book, and when I described the struggle to her, the answer seemed to come to me as to what to do. So we talked about it some, not a great deal. She was entering her teens and interested in being with her friends.
Mm-hmm. And today, how does she feel about Una Spencer and Ahab's Wife?
Well, she's very enthusiastic about it, and
great.
You know, she hopes, as I hope, that it may be made into a movie. So, you know, we're happy to see the book being as widely read as it is. I just got news that it was chosen as a notable book by both Publishers Weekly and also the New York Times, a notable book for this year. So my daughter is very generous-spirited, and you know, I'm her mom, and I've always been the same. But at the same time, she's proud of me.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a wonderful thing for the two of you to share, because it began when you were together.
Yes, that's right. It really did. In that moment of listening to the audio tape of Moby Dick.
Hmm. Talk with us about how exactly you began to conjure Una Spencer, how you began to build her, if conjure isn't the right word.
Well, the first scene, the opening scene of the novel, came to me very readily. It's a scene where Una is giving birth to a child, her child with Ahab, and she's also helping the runaway slave, Susan. It's an exciting opening scene because there are a couple of very suspenseful actions in it. But then when I finished that scene, I did ask myself, what next? And I realized that in order to create a character whom Ahab could love, that I needed to go back into Una's childhood. So that's what I did. I started a long flashback at that point. And Una grows up originally in the woods of Kentucky. Her father is something of a religious fanatic. He wants people to believe exactly what he believes, and he's quite intolerant of other people's religious views. And he really becomes obsessive about this and cruel to Una. She's of a naturally skeptical and questioning turn of mind. Her mother is sympathetic to her and sends her to an island lighthouse kept by her own sister and her sister's husband. So when Una is 12, she goes to live on the lighthouse. And this is a world in great contrast to the dark woods of Kentucky. It's a world of light and air. She makes friends with the lighthouse tower itself. She loves to climb it and be up there in the air feeling in charge of the world, and it's a very beautiful world of ocean and birds and clouds. So this part of Una's background is one that strengthens her in the sense of a family that's very harmonious and full of imagination and self-reliant, independent. Through both of these childhood experiences, Una does a lot of reading. So she also has the whole world of books to refer to. Eventually, she does leave the island disguised as a boy and gets a job as a cabin boy on a whaling ship. Then her world really opens up because she sees the world of work and danger and the physical vastness of the world even beyond her perch up in the lighthouse. Terrible things happen on this ship. It is eventually rammed by a whale, and Una survives an ordeal at sea. This is the section of the book where I feel that she really plumbs the depths and becomes, in a sense, someone equaled to Ahab.
Mm-hmm.
She does survive, but it's at great cost, and people very dear to her don't survive. So these are the sorts of backgrounds that I wanted to give Una. I wanted you know, she's a young girl who appreciates an older man, so she can't be too conventional in entering into that world, and she has to have some depth to her and intelligence for Ahab to respond the way he did. So it was a big challenge to create a character who was a plausible wife for a man who would say, I see my wife and my child in your eye and want very much to go home. So I did not want to make Una a perfect or overly idealized person. This was important to me. I think that there is often a lack of moral complexity in the depiction of women characters. I actually learned this from one of my students who focused on it, Mary Dalton, who was my student at Vermont College. And she pointed this out, and it rumbled around in my brain for a long time. And when I started to work with Una, I thought, yes, I want a person of moral complexity, not someone who is completely pure. I think we all struggle and make mistakes, and I wanted that to be a part of her character very much. Una is named somewhat for the lady in Edmund Spenser's The Fairy Queen. She's the lady who accompanies the Red Cross Knight, and it's the Red Cross Knight's job to slay the dragon. So I saw in Ahab someone who'd given himself a kind of mission, slaying the dragon of the sea as the whale. And Una in Spenser is represented as bold and brave and brave and loyal and truthful. And I did want Una to have some of these characteristics, but not to the extent of making her an allegorical figure. I also wanted a character who could grow and change. She's an anti-romantic character in some ways. There's not just one and only one love in her life, which is part of the premise of a lot of the romantic viewpoint. But instead, in order to survive, she's a person who, if her life is swept away from her, she tries to build a new one. She doesn't fixate on the past. And this is a way in which she differs a lot from Ahab. Ahab's story ends in death and destruction. The whole Pequod goes down, all hands on board, except for one who tells the tale, drown. Una's story does not end in death and destruction. She's gone through adversity, and she comes out triumphant, feeling at home in the universe, and that there is a place for her in the grand scheme of things. In a sense, it's an ordinary, unheroic kind of triumph that Una has, but it's a triumph that I think is available to all of us.
I think it's very interesting that you have Una tested when the ship she's aboard is wrecked by a whale, and that she is able to have an understanding and an appreciation for Ahab that another woman would not have. And I think it's interesting in the passage that you read for us that already there's a foreshadowing of the obsession that Ahab has with the whale, Moby Dick, when he tells Una he will bring her crown fashioned from the whale's jaw. We understand there that something is, you know, if you don't need to read Moby Dick to read this book, you are absolutely right. But we understand that there is something there that is troubling, and yet Una is able to. She accepts that is part and parcel of who her husband is.
Yes, she does. Deep into the book, she does try to persuade him not to pursue Moby Dick. She says, aim your harpoon at yourself, fragment your monomania. Melville calls him a monomaniac, and so do I. I mean, that's what he becomes. He wasn't necessarily always that way. So she does try verbally to persuade him to rethink his mission. But when she's not successful, then she accepts who he is and the fate he's chosen for himself. She has that much reverence for him and respect, so that she doesn't stop loving him because he's, in a sense, become mad with obsession. She does love him And she tries, and she regrets that she can't persuade him otherwise. Mm. She very much upbraids herself. If only I had been able to speak better, he wouldn't have done this. But she does finally accept who he is, and I think that that acceptance is implied in the way that Ahab thinks of her when he's at sea.
Did you ever feel that you were being a little bit cheeky writing this book in terms of taking on Melville? This is, I know this is a question that everyone in the world has asked. But.
Well, certainly, I've done very well with the criticism of this, but some of the critics have posed the question, how dare she? This is Moby Dick. And then they say, I know, she did it for money. But, I mean, there are a lot of other ways to make writing that are easier than writing a book that's a companion piece to Moby Dick if one wants to make money from it. And my motivation, as I said, was something that came out of the air for me quite unexpectedly. I wasn't expecting to write this book at all. So I defend myself a little bit about those charges. But was it a cheeky thing to do? Well, perhaps it was from anyone else's point of view looking at me. But for me, I didn't feel so much intimidated by Moby Dick as inspired by it. And I read it constantly as I was working on my own book. Sometimes I would open it at random to see what I had to learn that day, because there's so much to learn in every sentence, certainly every paragraph of Moby Dick, for a writer about how to handle language, depth of thought. And I tried to write the best book I possibly could, and I revised it many times. I worked very hard at it, mm-hmm. and my mind was not really on the question, what will people think of you for trying to do this or for wanting to do this? I was caught up in the dream of what I was doing, and that world was uppermost in my mind, not how the real world might regard such an act as this.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear writers talk about living with their characters. What was it like living with Una?
Well, I certainly did live with Una. Whenever I couldn't be writing, because I was also teaching a job and a half and running a literary magazine and doing a lot of other things, being a parent, it was constantly in my mind. And if I saw the sunshine fall in a certain way and had a response to it, I sort of felt, Una could feel this too. I didn't want to hold back anything from the creation of this character. I thought, whatever I can think or feel, so can she, in a mode appropriate to her time. I went to Nantucket four different times to work on the book, to do research, but also just to get a sense of the atmosphere there. In the end of the first week I was there, I dreamed Una's dreams. By this I mean I dreamed about characters in the book, but about things they hadn't done yet, and some characters who were not in the book. And I knew how Una felt about these characters beyond what I had written in the book. And when I woke up, I knew what had happened. I had dreamed her dreams, and I was very happy, because I feel that to make a big book like this, a saga, an epic, mm-hmm. that to have the intensity I wanted for it, I needed to know my character very intimately, and to dream her dreams suggested to me, yes, you can know her as intimately as you need to. This is one of the things that I think my book tries to do, is to have a large scope and at the same time to be very intimately involved with this particular character. So it was wonderful for me to live through her eyes. When she is approaching this island lighthouse, she's 12 years old, and she sees there's some white goats on it. And then she and I saw something else jumping up and down, and it wasn't a goat. I wasn't quite sure what it was. And as I stared through Una's eyes, I saw that it was a little girl, and it must be her little cousin, Franny, who was wearing a white apron jumping up and down. And I hadn't known Franny existed until I looked through Una's eyes and saw something and then saw it more clearly. And there were many instances like that in the book that completely surprised me because I was dwelling within them. It may sound a little wacky. I hope it doesn't sound too wacky. I consider myself to be quite sane.
I don't think it sounds wacky at all. How many of us have said, I'll sleep on it?
Yes, that's right. And I think our unconscious works for us. To me, when I'm writing, I speak to the text, and then it speaks back to me, and I need to listen to see where it wants to go. Actually, Tolstoy said this same thing about his writing. He said that his writing was never worth much unless he came around a bend in the river and saw something he had not expected to see. So there is this unconscious or irrational or gift of the gods kind of process in writing a book, particularly a big book that you live with for a long time.
When you're writing a large book, and you know, it keeps you in your chair. I mean, just, you know, riveted there from the get-go. Your book does. How do you, as a writer, keep that intensity going over a long period of time, over you know, over revision after revision, and as you mentioned, you know, you were teaching, you were doing the literary journal. You know, how do you keep the intensity up when your schedule is full up?
Well, I think it was the power of the concept that really kept the intensity up for me. That power just simply never decreased. My work habit was such that I would begin each day's work by rereading just what I had written the day before. I didn't go farther back because you can spend a whole new day rereading your old writing if you go very far back. But it's very comfortable to read what you did the last time you were sitting in that chair. And from reading over that part, I would also revise it at the same time. And I would let it speak to me about where it wanted to go next. I would, in a sense, get the pitch to keep on singing through rereading. And so that helped me. Each day was linked to the day before, and that helped me to keep going. Sometimes I would have new ideas that were not supposed to come next chronologically. They skipped way forward in the story. And whenever I had any powerful idea, if it was supposed to be next or not, I wrote that idea. This is, you know, seizing the inspiration. And then after I did that scene, the scene in the open boat after the whale boat is rammed and sinks, and Una is alone in a small boat, or not alone, she's there with a few friends. That scene came to me ahead of time, and then it seemed to me as though I'd tossed a grappling hook up ahead of my usual narrative line. It had sunk in into that scene, and then I pulled myself up the line, up the rope, hand over hand, to that scene. So I had to fill in the space between where I had been and this inspired scene, so to speak, that had come much later. So that was another method besides rereading what I'd written the day before. In terms of the revision and how I kept going on that, I would sometimes run across a word in my other reading and think, oh, I use that word. Now let me see, how did I use that word? And I would go back into the text and read the sentence and then the paragraph, and before long, I was back in it, and 3 hours had passed, and it was like going down a rabbit hole or being sucked into a black hole. I simply didn't know time existed. It was a marvelous, enchanted experience. I was as alert as I could possibly be for polishing it up, but at the same time, when I didn't have any impatience because I didn't have any sense of time. So the revision process, as well as the original writing, was a great pleasure to me. It's like, say, if you're polishing a piece of wood and your hands sort of fall in love with a piece of wood, you want to touch it again, and you can hardly take your hands away from it. It's such a pleasure to smooth and shape, and that's the way the revision was for me.
So it was an exhilarating process.
It was. You know, it truly was, and it's probably a good thing. I had some ordinary life to take care of, or I might have gone off forever. I don't know in this world.
I know a lot of writers hate this question, but I always want to know after I've read a good book, what's next?
Oh, well, there's no question I hate, and certainly not that one, Celeste. I appreciate your interest. I'm speaking to you from Auburn, Alabama today, and my next novel will be set in Alabama, where I grew up, and it'll be a civil rights novel, I think, set in Birmingham. Mm. So I'm not sure what all will happen in that book, but that's what I have in mind to do next.
Mm. Well, the best to you. Godspeed.
Thank you.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine has been Sina Jeter-Nasland. Look for her book, Ahab's Wife, or The Stargazer. It's published by William Morrow.